And you're welcome back to the programme. 1850 50 60 00 is our number. I was reading a report this morning in one of the papers, I think it was the Irish Daily Mail, but it was covered in most of the papers this morning. A new survey by AA Insurance saying that 70% of their customers believe that we pay out far too much in personal injury claims in this country. And of course, there has long been a debate about the fact that here in Ireland, our payouts are about 2 or 2.5 times that of the United Kingdom. So why would a whiplash pain in Ireland be 2.5 times more painful than it would be in the UK? That's the kind of argument that's been made, and Conor Faulkner is making the point and having a bit of a swipe at the legal profession in the papers this morning. Anyway, that aside, I mention it because in studio with me this morning, I am joined by Caroline McLaughlin, a partner at Callan Tansey Solicitors with offices in Sligo, Boyle and Dublin. It is Boyle, isn't it, Caroline?
Good morning. Boyle and Galway.
And Galway. Good morning. Thanks for coming in. So, we're talking personal injuries this morning. Why has words like whiplash or soft tissue injury suddenly become kind of bad, dirty words in this country? It's kind of sad, isn't it?
It is. It's become a taboo subject, really, Tommy. And when you open the papers day in, day out, it's all we're reading about. 60,000 claim thrown out of court, fraud, that we're paying too much compensation. And really, it's the focal point, and it's all people are reading on a day-to-day basis. So I can understand that the public perception to claims is very negative. But I think within that, we can't forget the genuine person who is injured, and who, if you're involved in an accident and you're reading these papers, you would be quite reluctant to do anything about it. Fearful, what would your neighbours think? What would the general public think? So I think we need to face it head on. And, you know, we need to not be afraid to deal with someone's personal injuries. If somebody has a genuine injury, under the Constitution, they're entitled to fair procedures and access to justice.
Yeah, and because we don't see blood or we don't see stitches, you know, when we don't see the physical consequences of an accident, we sometimes forget that there is, of course, the pain you can't see.
Yeah, absolutely. And all of these cases, it's not just a case that somebody alleges they have an injury. It all has to be underpinned by a doctor verifying that that injury does exist. So various tests are in place by the orthopaedic surgeons and consultants throughout the country, and they can test the veracity as to whether these injuries are there, how long they're likely to last, what kind of treatment is needed. And I'm sure a lot of your listeners, many unfortunately, will probably have experienced some form of soft tissue or whiplash injury over the years, and will tell you that it does last a long time. While people can have a positive experience, for others it's a very long road to recovery, with rehabilitation, physiotherapy and a lot of costs that are associated with it. So it's not just a general throwaway term that unfortunately it has become.
Now, if you are legitimately injured in, whether it's a slip in a bath in a hotel, whether it's filling petrol at a filling station, whatever it might be, or a car crash, you don't, I understand, go into court saying, I want 100 grand or I want 60 grand. You don't make a claim on the basis of a specific figure, is that correct?
Certainly not in relation to your injury. So how the courts in Ireland work is the majority of claims will be brought in the circuit court or the High Court. The Circuit Court can award compensation between 15,000 up to 60,000, so it's a huge bracket, and similarly the High Court then will offer compensation from 60,000 upwards. So if a client comes to us and tells us about their injury and their various expenses, we have to estimate which court it's most appropriate to be brought in. And you'll have to remember, for some cases there could be 30,000-40,000 worth of loss of earnings, hospital bills. If somebody has private health insurance, they will be entitled to get that money back also as well. So there's a lot more involved than rather just the injury itself. So nobody goes into court and says, I want 60,000 because I have a whiplash injury. They wouldn't get 60,000 because of a whiplash injury. So it's a band, and in all of these reports in the media, that's sort of the headline all the time, and that catches people because obviously that's a significant amount of money. And if you're struggling to pay your premium and hear of somebody going in looking for that, so I just suppose I wanted to deal with that head on, that it's not the case. Nobody goes in and says, I want X amount for my injury. It's a matter for the courts to assess.
There has been changes in legislation, and we'll talk about that in a few minutes time. You know, I did mention that, you know, this morning in the papers, Conor Faulkner is having a little bit of a swipe at the legal profession. But I mean, the legal profession's argument, and I'm sure it's yours as well, is that if somebody comes through your door Caroline and says they have a legitimate injury and they have a doctor's certificate to back that up, you have to take that at face value.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, you get a set of instructions. It's backed up by a medical report. If it's a case where liability is an issue, where it's not a straightforward case, you might have to rely on an engineer to confirm that something, you know, that something on the footpath was dangerous and it was a responsibility, whether it's of the council or a private individual. So while you get a set of facts, as a solicitor, you do have to test those facts. So it's not that you accept everything that you're told, but you have to take it at face value. Yeah. When you hear the other side of the argument as well, there may be merit in that. So you have to consider the case in a whole, but it's not for me when somebody comes in to me for me to turn around and say, well, I don't think you're injured. I'm not qualified to do that. I have to rely on the medical profession to say what the extent of the injury is or not.
Already, and I see it on the screen here lighting up in front of me, it's underpinned in this particular one that says, whatever about blaming the legal profession for the cost of high claims for personal injuries, I also believe that insurance companies need to take a lot more responsibility. A lot of the time, they argue that it's cheaper to sort this out of court than going into court and have all the legal costs. Is that something that solicitors comment on?
Yeah, it can be the case. You know, it's a very different approach. And obviously, we deal with insurance companies and we have a very good relationship with insurance companies. We deal with them every day of the week. But sometimes it's not logical how certain cases are dealt with. You know, certain cases that are very straightforward that should settle at an early stage don't. And other cases that it's the opposite, go the duration. So it's just not... There doesn't seem to be a straightforward approach by all insurance companies. And, you know, I suppose it's a numbers game to the insurance company. Legal costs are expensive. So if they can settle a case and avoid incurring additional costs, I can see the merit in that as well. So I suppose it does depend on the facts.
Yeah,
of any
a bit of a
catch-22.
It is,
yeah, absolutely.
Tell me about the changes in legislation that affect personal injuries now.
So I think we discussed the last time that I was here, Tommy, about PIAB, and hopefully your listeners are familiar. PIAB is the Injuries Board, and all claims for personal injuries must go through this board. So as an individual, if you have an injury or an accident, you have no choice but to submit an application to this board.
And PIAB stands for, I presume,
Personal Injuries Assessment Board.
And they're made up of who?
So there's a group of assessors who assess claims. So in the first instance, a claimant will submit a very straightforward application form, setting out details of their accident, attaching a medical report. PIAB then will notify the other party, so the respondent or the responsible or alleged responsible party. They will be given then a period of 90 days to say whether PIAB can proceed to value a case or not. So PIAB won't determine that a case is wrong or right or who's at fault. Their only concern is evaluation. Okay, so the insurance company has the option to say, well, we want to contest this case, so we don't want you to value it, and the case is thrown out by PIAB. But if PIAB keep the case, they will have an individual independently assessed. They look for receipts in relation to expenses, and then ultimately they'll make a valuation in a case, and an individual then has the opportunity to accept or reject, as does an insurance company.
Okay. So let's just take a kind of a quick test case. I'm staying in a hotel and I slip in the bath, okay, and I say there was no, you know, the bath was very slippy. I'll say there was no mat down to stop me from slipping and so on. And I slip and I dislocate my back and I'm off work and I'm in dreadful pain. So do I make the, well, obviously the first thing I should do is tell the hotel owner, should I or not?
Yeah, absolutely. That's something that comes in with one of the changes that I'll explain in a minute. It is so important to notify. You know, it's for somebody to have an accident and then come to a solicitor a month later, evidence may have been destroyed in the meantime. So it's really important if something happens to you in any premises, public or private, that you report it.
To the responsible party or
the owners, to give them an opportunity, because obviously they will have obligations to their own insurance company to report. So if they're only finding out a couple of months later, and one of the amendments does deal with that, actually, I'll touch on that now, under the Civil Liability Act from 2004 up until January of this year, an individual had to notify within 2 months of the occurrence of an accident. So they had to notify by way of letter their intention to bring a claim, which was quite a short period, to 2 months, 8 weeks to get legal advice and to issue a letter. That time period since January has been reduced to 1 month. So within a period of 1 month, an injured party must now have a letter of claim issued to the responsible party. And if they don't, a court can draw inferences from that, and they can penalise a plaintiff on cost. So it's a crucial time period. The reason being is that companies or businesses need to be able to preserve CCTV footage. So my advice to people would be, in the first instance, don't just leave. Make sure it's known what has happened. You know, you may not know, there may not be a case out of it, but to protect your own interests. And unfortunately, it puts a huge obligation on people to try and get legal advice quite fast, because a 4 week period isn't very long to secure, you know, and to deal with your injury if you're in hospital for a number of weeks.
Yeah,
you know,
it can
so
be difficult.
It's a very difficult requirement the claimants now have, you know, and it is a constant battle for a claimant. They're constantly met by time periods, but a 4 week time period in particular is very onerous for anyone to deal with.
But I suppose in say the case of the famous bath, you know, it wouldn't take a lot to sort of ring reception, say, look, I've had an accident, I need somebody to come up here. And, you know, maybe in the middle of a pain crisis, that mightn't always be possible. But it's something people should bear in mind.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Just, and it's the whole point is to give the insurance company, they need to have, or the defendants need to have an opportunity to deal with it too. They need to have an opportunity to defend, to see what they need, if they need to take photographs or, you know, so it just can't be landed on them by surprise.
So then, okay, I'm in hospital with my dislocated back. I do get in touch with my solicitor and tell them I've had this accident in the hotel. So then, does the solicitor normally write to the PIAB? Or
absolutely. Yeah. So the solicitor in the first instance will write to the responsible party,
which is in this case the Personal Injuries Assessment Board.
So in your
board.
Case it would be the hotel.
Okay, so the solicitor whoever. Will write to the hotel.
Oh, absolutely, yes.
And so say Mr. Marin fell in the bath and he's very sore.
Absolutely. So the solicitor will put the respondent on notice of the fact that they've received instructions in relation to a claim and the allegations that are being made. They will also set about getting a medical report from a treating doctor confirming the nature of the injuries. And then at that stage, the solicitor can refer the matter to PIAB. So in terms of personal injury claims, generally, there's a huge comparison here. You have to notify within a month, but you have 2 years to bring a claim. So that's the time period within which a solicitor can work with. But obviously, it's better to get these things up and running sooner rather than
and
later.
And can the hotel's solicitor also get in touch with PIAB?
Yeah, so what happens is that PIAB will write then to the hotel, in your example, will write to the hotel's insurance company, and they can write back and say, well, you know, we don't allow you to assess this case because we're going to defend it.
It's going to go to court.
So it's the insurance company makes the call as to what level of involvement PIAB will actually have. If they say no, it's out, and that's it.
And do PIAB, they don't bring the alleged victim before them to discuss?
No,
it's all done
not.
by through solicitors.
It's all done through correspondence. It was actually set up that people would do it themselves, but it is quite a complicated process. So the majority of people still use solicitors, so it's all on paper. And it follows a various format. Now, I think at the minute, PIAB say that they assess claims within about 7 months. By law, they can assess within 9 to 15 months. So it's all on paper. There's no court attendances. The only people that you have to attend is with an independent doctor to assess you independently on PIAB's behalf. So it's not a court hearing.
Yeah, exactly. So they consult each other and then they come up with a figure.
Absolutely. So they have assessors who will be assigned to the case who will examine what's called the book of quantum, which shows the bands of various injuries. They'll come up with a figure in relation to the injury and then all of the other expenses, hospital bills and so on. And then ultimately they'll write out with their valuation of the injury in financial terms, and then it's a matter for the claimant and the respondent to decide whether they're happy to accept that or not. And both can accept or reject, and unless there's a meeting of minds, it doesn't become binding. If they do agree, it becomes like a formal court order.
And can either party challenge the amount of money allocated by PIAB?
No.
Okay, so if they say
it's a one-off figure,
80 grand, they're not going. You can't go back and say, well, look, I'll settle for 100 if no.
No, unless it's done directly with the insurance company. It's a take it or leave it offer. And if there's no negotiation whatsoever.
Right, so have we touched on both of the changes in legislation?
Yeah, so there's certain changes then as well in relation to PIAB and how they operate. So PIAB have always operated on the basis that there's no cost implication. So you can go through PIAB. If you decide not to accept it, you don't have to pay the other side's costs, and vice versa. So it's a, I suppose it's a less daunting procedure for claimants to go through. PIAB's rules have been amended, however, effective from April of this year, which allows a court to penalise either party on costs if they fail to provide additional information or PIAB or documentation to a PIAB assessor, if they fail to provide assistance to any of their experts, or if they fail to attend the independent examination arranged by PIAB. So while the legislation says that these requirements are on both claimants or respondents, they all really affect a claimant rather than a respondent. So if you fail to go to your medical appointment, a court later on down the line could award costs against you. So it's a huge implication, and one that people should be made aware of. And it's to oblige people to comply with PIAB, and I suppose with a view to trying to get as many cases resolved within the PIAB process rather than going to the courts.
Hmm. What about somebody who hurts themselves at work? I mean, most employers have employee insurance, public liability insurance.
Yeah, certainly.
So if I decide to try electrocuting myself, gosh, I'm doing a lot of stuff to myself today, but if I go down to our apps room, as we call it here, which is a huge room with all kinds of transformers and lights and wires, and I decide, I touch something thinking I'm fixing it, and I get myself an electric shock and end up in my local GP surgery. And he says, look, you better take some time off here. You've been badly electrocuted, effectively. Will the public liability insurance of the employee kick in? Sorry, of the employer kick in?
Yeah,
or will it be the employee insurance?
Well, obviously, most employers will have employer's liability insurance. And actually, that's the one area where claims have actually increased in 2017 with PIAB. The claims against employers have increased by 7.5%. But an employer case, like any other case, you have to prove an element of fault. So obviously, if an employee does something outside of the scope of what they were employed to do.
If it's said on the door, do not enter.
Exactly.
Qualified personnel only should enter this room.
Absolutely. Or if somebody received, you know, maybe in the somebody employed at the HSE, if they received a certain specific training and acted outside of that training. So like every other case, just because it's an employer situation, sometimes there is the presumption I was injured at work and I should be compensated. But you have to prove some shortcoming on the part of your employer, or some failure in the equipment that you had or the training that you had. So you have to win your case. You have to prove that there was a negligence or a breach of duty shown to you. So it's not just a straightforward issue of I'm injured at work and I should be compensated. It's not how it works.
So what we've really established today is that there is a robust system in place that for those who are making bogus claims, they have to cross a lot of hurdles before they'd fool anybody.
Absolutely. And even in the last 10 years, it has tightened so much more. The courts are fully equipped to deal with not only fraudulent claims, but also somebody who might exaggerate their injury or make things sound a little bit worse. So the courts are fully equipped to deal with that by way of dismissing cases, and also by way of a criminal conviction in serious cases. So that does happen, and we see it from the headlines. You know, the courts are taking a very strong approach to these types of cases. And I suppose from the legal profession point of view, the fear is that the very genuine, timid claimant who, you know, is very fearful of that. Like it's unbelievable the amount of people who have very straightforward cases that are almost scared to exercise that right. And that's something that, you know, it shouldn't be the case. And I think the issue of fraud and compensation amounts, it all gets rolled into one, and it's not really fair to the genuine person who is out of pocket and dealing with a very difficult situation in their lives.
Lots of calls in asking Caroline why, you know, are our claims 2.5 times higher than in England, or a lot higher than most of the mainland European countries?
It's the system that we have. You know, I suppose I can't specifically answer that other than to say we have judiciary who are independent and who assess these injuries, and that's the parameters within which we have to work. I suppose there's various articles that said, you know, we can't compare like that. Obviously in the States things are much, much higher. You know, this is the system that we have. And it's something that is being looked at. Obviously, there's a personal injuries commission has been set up, and there was arguments that there would be a cap on damages for whiplash, and the Bar Council and the judiciary, you know, did take issue with that because they felt that it would infringe somebody's constitutional rights, and that it couldn't be capped. And what the alternative that has been suggested is that there will be judicial guidelines put in place to set in some respect the levels, you know, and over time. And I know people may not be seeing it, but claims have reduced, you know, certainly in terms of what we're advising people that they might achieve in court, certainly has reduced over the last number of years. It's not something that's going to happen overnight.
Yeah. You know? Motor car accidents, obviously, when you talk about whiplash, I would imagine 90% of whiplash cases result from a very sudden impact and a jerk to your neck. And again, we're getting an awful lot of texts on this from people who are saying these would be people now who may have caused the alleged perpetrators, who maybe had run into the back of somebody's car and felt that, look, they were only, one says, I was only going about 12, 15 miles an hour. It was only a tap. And then I got a letter from my insurance company to say they had settled the case without even contacting the insurance policy holder.
Yeah.
Have you heard of cases like that?
It can happen. And there's certain cases, I suppose, they're met with the defence that it's a low impact. But there is case law, certainly from New Zealand, and I think Canada, there's very strong case law to say that even a small impact can result in an injury. And that is something, and the insurance companies are aware of that. Certainly an insurance company will not settle a case unless they feel that there is a chance that the person will ultimately be successful. And there is, you know, and we've seen it ourselves in cases, you know, certain cars can withhold certain levels of impact, and it doesn't mean that somebody isn't injured. I can understand from an insured person's point of view that can be frustrating, but really, until someone is in that situation, it's hard. Yeah. It's hard to understand.
What about cases? I mean, the anomalies that come up on the screen are quite amazing. What about a case where somebody, a farmer, is suggesting that he purchased a fairly expensive piece of farm machinery that had a very faulty TVO shaft or PTO shaft, and they ultimately ended up losing a number of fingers as a result of what they believe was a faulty PTO shaft? Would the case in that instance be taken against the manufacturer of the machine?
Did they purchase directly from the manufacturer?
Well, they would have purchased it through a co-op or through a farming machinery seller.
Yeah, so normally it would be against whoever sold it, and okay, potentially the manufacturer as well, if it was a defect with the product rather than...
And if the person who sold it in good faith said they bought it in as a brand new piece of equipment, surely they shouldn't be held responsible.
Yeah, you'd like to think that the manufacturer would indemnify them if there was a defect with the product that rendered it dangerous. And obviously that's a very, very serious injury for someone to lose digits to their hand. Very serious. So it would be something to invest.
And another one a lot of people are saying is, well, if God forbid you were to lose an arm or a leg, or as you said, you know, a devastating, you know, fingers, whatever it might be, the likelihood of going for an assessment would be slim, I presume, to nil. This would be more a case of ending up in the High Court, would it?
It would depend. You know, with PIAB, they themselves have a clause that says that if they find an injury is too complex or one that they won't have a clear idea as to evaluation, that they can release it. So it very much depends. PIAB do assess very big cases when it's clear. So it's not necessarily the case that losing an arm or fingers would end up in court. It would very much depend on the attitude of the insurance companies and whether PIAB felt themselves comfortable to put a fair valuation on it. And if they feel that they can't, or if they feel that it's complex, they can release it so that a claimant can bring court proceedings should they wish.
Another question I would never have thought to ask, but it's a relevant one. Are PIAB case settlements available to the public?
PIAB issue statistics every year. I think the most recent statistics at the minute are from 2017. So they give an idea of the number of cases, and they give an idea of the valuation, but they don't release.
They don't name,
as far
shame.
As I'm aware, they don't release. Certainly, they don't release names. They don't release each individual, but they do release the valuation of the overall assessments that they make in any particular year, and that information is all available on their website, and the number of claims that they receive in any given year.
Okay. As I say, every case is different. I only mentioned the hotel because it came off the top of my head, but somebody actually says, do hotel owners and their staff have a responsibility to look after a person if they get injured on their premises when injuries are visible, i.e. should all of the hotel staff be allowed to give first aid? Well, I'm sure a lot of hotel staff would be.
Yeah, a lot would. And this often comes up when you first meet somebody, Tommy, that one of the things that really annoy people is the lack of concern after an injury has happened, you know. And I don't know whether it's fear on the part of a premises that they don't want to be nearly admitting responsibility, but it's something that always comes up, whether it's a car accident or an injury in a public location. And people always say, well, if they only, you know, asked me was I okay, or if they only rang an ambulance for me or showed some concern. And it causes a lot of hurt. So in most hotels, I would imagine that there's somebody who is qualified in first
and
aid and, you know, can deal with that to some extent.
I mean, and I don't know if it's still the case, but I remember when I was a younger fella, you know, if you did have a car accident, your car insurance would always say, do not accept responsibility, even if you're in the wrong, which I always felt was wrong. You know, if you do something that's not right and you cause an accident, you should have the courage to sort of put your hand up and say, I was wrong. And isn't that why we pay insurance?
Yeah, oh, absolutely. And it is, you know, it's still the case that people will admit at the scene when they're in the wrong. And I suppose that clause for an insurance company is to cover maybe the scenario where the driver isn't at fault, you know, where somebody wrongly thinks that they are. But it's something that should, you know, certainly it does help when it happens from an early stage. Even through the insurance company, it's helpful when they admit at an early stage that liability isn't an issue, because obviously there's a lot of hurt and a lot of additional stress that people are dealing with as well. But just touching on that as well, because we do receive still a lot of telephone calls from people who are insured and are involved in a car accident. So obviously if you are the person who is responsible for an accident, you should immediately telephone your insurance company and notify them that is the case. You don't need your own solicitor. Some people do incur the expense of going to their own solicitor to write a letter in response.
Sure.
Not necessary.
Yeah.
Contact your insurance company. That's what you're paying your insurance for.
Okay, have we covered, as they say, every scenario?
Yeah, I think so.
And if there was a key message you'd like to get out this morning, Caroline, based on all of the stuff we've been talking about for the last 25 minutes, what would it be?
Just really, Tommy, that I would hate to think that people are dissuaded by the newspaper articles or fearful, you know, our country has a right of access to the courts, a right of justice, and that people should seek advice if they're not sure. Seek advice at the earliest opportunity now because of these changes in the law, and protect their interests. And while we have cases that you know, that shouldn't be there, fraudulent cases, exaggerated cases, for the genuine people in our community that are injured, they should be protected, and they shouldn't feel that they can't seek access to justice.
Very good. Well, thanks very much for coming in. Caroline McLaughlin, partner with Callan Tansey. And if you'd like to contact Callan Tansey, possibly we can give the Ballina number.
Certainly.
Is 096-71618. And the offices are located in Tone Street in Ballina. That's 096-71618. Caroline, thanks for coming
in. Thanks very much, Tommy.
And no doubt we'll be talking again in the future. That's Caroline McLaughlin there from Callan Tansey Solicitors. And thank you, by the way, to everybody who got in touch.